Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host for this episode, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, a history chappy. Today, I am delighted to be joined by the author of a brand new book, and it's an absolutely fascinating title because it synthesizes lots of different strands of knowledge, and it's entitled The Dawn of Language, How We Came to Talk. And the author is Dr. Sverker Johansson. Dr. Johansson, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Versus History Podcast to talk about your book. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me. Very happy to be with you.
The pleasure really, really is all ours. Now, I've not read all of the book, but I've read chunks of it, and it's absolutely fascinating. So it's entitled The Dawn of Language, Axes, Lies, Midwifery, and How We Came to Talk. So this book is, as I said, it's fascinating because it's about what we're doing now, talking, using language. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, if that's okay, Dr. Johansson, and your background before getting onto your book? So you, your background, and then a little bit about your book, if that's okay.
Well, I'm from Sweden, working at the University of Dalarna in central Sweden. I'm Dr. Johansson with a PhD in physics, particle physics, but I left physics long ago because I found language and linguistics.
Aha.
So fascinating.
Therein lies the connection. I wondered where the connection was, and you just explained it for us. Please carry on.
And I was also getting tired of doing particle physics research with 500 or 1,000 co-authors on every publication to industrialized research.
Of course.
And I've always been fascinated about the origins of everything. Where do we come from? Where does the universe come from? But when I started studying languages, I found that we knew very little about where does language come from. We know about quite a bit about the history of individual languages. Where does English come from? We have a good idea about that. But where does language as such come from? That was an unsolved problem when I started studying linguistics. And it's still not completely solved today, but we are making progress.
Well, your book has helped us make some progress. That's definitely a massive step in the right direction.
So that became my main research direction for the past 20 years, together with many other people. It is not this book that has made progress, but this book summarizes our progress over many years and with many people participating. Not all of whom will agree with everything I write, but that's the way it is. Still a contentious
Absolutely.
Topic.
Everything in history is, I think.
But language is such a fascinating story, and it's such an important story. Like you said, it's what we're doing all the time, what we're doing now. Language is the quintessential part of what it is to be human. It's very difficult to understand humanity without understanding something about language. It's difficult to understand how we became human, how we evolved into human beings, without understanding the dawn of language. Because the dawn of language was really a key event separating us from the other apes once upon a time. And that's the event that I'm trying to illuminate in this book.
Let's try and get to the man behind the book before we get to the book then. So a little scenario question for you, just a fun one to get the proverbial ball rolling. If you were sent away to a desert island, Dr. Johansson, for 5 years, and you've got water and you've got enough food to keep you ticking over, but you can take with you one musical album, one drink aside from water, and one book with you for company. What would they be and why? So you've got one album, one drink, and one book.
Okay. The album, it would be something by Pink Floyd.
And great choice.
I might have said The Dark Side of the Moon, but I know that one by heart. So probably Amagam I would bring, because I haven't listened that to death yet.
Well, I think you would over the 5 years. I think you'd move towards that point.
Yep.
Great choice. Absolutely sterling choice. Okay, drink and book.
I was going to say tea, but then you said that I have unlimited water as well.
You do have unlimited water. If you pick tea, that will keep a lot of English people very happy, because I think tea is the English national drink. Okay, if we're going for tea, that's a great choice.
But if we have water, I might bring whiskey instead.
Fantastic. American, Irish, or Scottish? What would you go for?
Scottish.
I thought you'd say that.
Smoke flavored. Maybe, how do you pronounce it? Cowl Illa?
Cowila, yeah, that's from Isla. Very, very hippie tea, very, very smoky whiskies. I suppose along the lines of Talisker as well. Great choice, right. And the book?
And the book, well, I'm a bit torn there. Either I will bring Raft Building for Dummies, or I will bring an omnibus edition of The Lord of the Rings.
One would be very, very useful, and one would keep you very, very entertained. I see the logic behind your answers there. Thank you very, very much indeed for playing along with that, Dr. Johansson. So it's helped us get to know the man behind this brilliant book and the fantastic research that's gone into compiling it, along with many other fellow scholars as well. Okay, then. We've sort of touched on this already. Just tell us, Dr. Johansson, what is your new book all about in essence, and why is it so important or significant in your view?
The book is important because it helps us understand how we became human and helps us to understand ourselves and our origins. And it's important also because there are certainly other books that touch upon the dawn of language. But this book, it's important because it is an evidence-driven story. It's not only a just-so story speculating about how humans got language, but it's also not just a catalog of facts about language. It's a story. But the narrative in the story is built upon the evidence that's available from many different areas, from many different disciplines that bear upon the dawn of language one way or another. So throughout the book, I'm weaving together strands of evidence and gradually an image of the dawn of language emerges.
I suppose it gets to the heart of what the book's about, but it's a question I've been asked myself. I was asked it last year by one of my A-level students while we were learning about Russian Revolution 1917 to 1991. And I asked this particular student, what would you like to know about? And she said, language, where does it come from? And my answer was pretty pathetic. It was sort of, I don't really know, but I watched a TED-Ed video on it once, but I can't really remember what it said, but it's fascinating. You should watch it. So this question is an important one. Language. Where did it come from, and when and why did our ancestors start using it? I know you can't be exactly specific, but an approximation would do. Where did it come from, and when and why did our ancestors start using it?
Start with when. Homo sapiens, our species, has language. Neanderthals had language too. Pretty strong evidence for that. And that means our common ancestor had language as well. And that brings us back to the species Homo erectus. So the dawn of language would be during the tenure of Homo erectus, which would be somewhere from 1.5 million years ago up to a bit more than 500,000 years ago when Neanderthals and Homo sapiens went their separate ways. So we have a 1 million year window there, somewhere in that window. And if I were a betting man, I would bet on the early part of that window for the very first language. The first way of communicating that can be called language, that is something more than what the other apes do. And where did it come from? It came from a perfect storm of circumstances. A combination of Homo erectus evolving into a highly cooperative species, a helpful species, a species where people actually helped each other and wanted to help each other. Because chimpanzees, for example, they can cooperate, but only on the basis of you scratch my back, I scratch yours. They are not spontaneously helpful. A chimpanzee will not help a stranger, but humans typically do. There's a pro-social mentality that distinguishes us from our fellow apes. And that's one leg of the perfect storm. And the next leg is cognitive and maybe better creative. Our ancestors at that point had evolved a creative mind, thinking new thoughts, thinking of new ways of doing things, and being smart enough to do something about it. And the third leg, that's the ecological circumstances. Homo erectus seeking food and specializing in food that's difficult to get, that's challenging to get, and food where cooperation helps, where it helps a lot, and food where communication helps. Recruiting your fellows to help cooperate with you. And those three, a species that wants to help each other, a species that has the cognitive capacity to be creative with communicating and asking for help, and a species where there's a lot to gain from mutual aid. The combination of those is unique for Homo erectus. And that's where language came from. People wanted to communicate, people who were able to communicate, and people who had something to communicate about that was helpful to them. And there we have a lot of the why as well. People had a lot to gain from better communication, and especially communication about what's not here and now. Communicating, imagining for yourself a scenario where you and some other guys cooperate to get food or whatever else, and being able to render that scenario, make it understandable to the others, explaining it to them, recruiting them, telling them how their help will let you all achieve a mutually beneficial goal.
Absolutely. And then we can fascinating. Have... Please carry on, please.
Yeah. Then we can have a long discussion about what was the topic of the first discussion. What did people actually cooperate about and this talk about and help each other with? Food acquisition is high on the list, but so is social talk. I mean, talking about how to get a mammoth, fine. But talking about who in the group can be trusted, who cannot be trusted, who has cheated me, that might be even more effective in maintaining the group and maintaining a happy, cooperative, helpful group. So talk about social matters, gossip if you want, might have been very important in the dawn of language. And I would say it's not one or the other. As soon as people had both the will and the means to communicate, they would communicate about anything where it's beneficial, which can be both material and social and whatever else.
Okay, next question. In your opinion, then, and in your research and in the book, to what extent is the evolution of language dependent on genes or on environment? I'm particularly interested in the environmental stuff, with being from a big city, lots of different influences. I've seen how language can evolve, incorporate words from other languages. I suppose it's particularly visible in places like New York, San Francisco, London, Paris, Berlin. So to what extent is the evolution of language dependent on genes or on the environment? Both, neither, or somewhere in between. Over to you.
Okay. To begin with, we should perhaps distinguish the evolution of language today, how languages change from year to year. That's one thing. And the evolution of language in a sense of how language, our language capacity evolved in our remote ancestors. That's a different issue. So my book is mainly about the latter. But if we talk about how language changes today, that's mostly a matter of what I would call cultural evolution. So there's no genetic change to speak of involved. And there are no relevant genetic differences between speakers of different languages, which is shown by adopted kids. A Chinese baby adopted to the United States will learn perfectly fine American English, and an American baby adopted into China will learn Chinese as a native language perfectly fine as well, which shows that genes do not control your native language. Your native language is a matter of the environment and the gradual changes of that native language over the years. That's the language as such that's evolving. Language itself, some words are used more and some are used less and get lost. Gradually changing due to the choices of speakers, conscious or unconscious choices. And that's a different kind of evolution, cultural evolution. But if we get back to the dawn of language, the original evolution of language, where language got started, there it's not a matter of genes or the environment. It has to be both. And there, I would argue that the very earliest dawn of language, the first glimmer of light on the linguistic horizon, that was environmental. People, given the three pillars I talked about before, the perfect storm, people started communicating creatively using whatever means at hand, using whatever genetic endowment they already had, not evolving genetically at first. It was not the sudden mutation that gave language, no matter what Noam Chomsky thinks about it. It was people communicating with the tools available. the genetic tools available. But once you got to that stage, once people were using language, it became a huge advantage for children to learn language quickly and effortlessly. The faster you learned language, the faster you became a full member of society. And so children evolved, humans evolved genetically to be better as babies in acquiring language. And when people became better at acquiring language, language itself could change. Language would be used more. Language could be more complex. And that would put even more pressure on learning language efficiently and quickly, driving us to more genetic evolution of our ability to learn language. And in parallel, driving the genetic evolution of our language organs, our voice, and our ability to control our voice to form language sounds was optimized for clear and distinct speech. So it was an ongoing feedback between the linguistic environment becoming richer and richer and more complex, the linguistic environment in the group, which means other people speaking. That was feeding into and driving genetic evolution of better speakers and better language learners, which would enrich the linguistic environment even more. So it would be a virtuous circle with genetic and environmental changes feeding into each other. So nature versus nurture, that's a misleading dichotomy. There's no interesting trait in human beings that is a matter of nature or nurture, and certainly not language. It's nature and nurture.
I think, again, this question dovetails nicely from the former. How, if at all, has globalization impacted on language?
Not as much as one might think. It's a lot of people, especially in Western countries, believe that we used to live in a monolingual world. We used to live in a world where in each country people spoke one language, period. And that now we have a lot of people moving around the globe and mixing up languages willy-nilly. But that's a misleading image, because those monolingual countries, they were very few, and it was for a very short period of time. For most of human history and in most of the world all the time, people have been used to contact with multiple languages always. In the old times, before the rise of nation states, which is most of human history, people in one village or in one tribe spoke one language, and people in the next tribe spoke another language. So it was an almost daily occurrence to encounter somebody speaking a different language. If we look at a place like New Guinea, where we are close to that state of nature still, in that small island, well, not that small, a lot larger than the British Isles, there are about 1,000 different languages spoken. It's pretty much one language per village.
Wow, that is amazing.
But people in different villages meet each other as much as people in two different villages in the UK or two different towns in the US meet each other. And so people meet people with other languages all the time. People marry people with other languages. So language contact is certainly not something that came with globalization. What has changed is the scale of languages and the breadth of language contact. In the old days, you had contact with maybe 3 or 4 or 5 neighboring tribes who spoke different languages, but that was it. But today, you can communicate with pretty much anybody anywhere on the globe. And the languages you have contact with are probably not the same as the languages I have contact with, but we are communicating with each other. And the network of people speaking different languages, it will be wider and more diverse. And the languages themselves are much larger. In the old days, typical number of speakers for one language was on the order of 1,000, not more. The number of people in one village, one tribe. Today, the average language has more like 1 million speakers. and some languages have a lot more, like English. In the old days, everybody who spoke the same language they knew each other. You basically never spoke your native language with a stranger. And today you do. Today we talk with strangers all the time. And with people with very different backgrounds. And that will affect the way we use language. So the scale of the language networks, that's the main change with globalization. Multilingualism is not new, but the scale of it has changed.
So it's all a case of scale and size. Thank you very much, Dr. Johansson. Okay, are there any surprising links between languages from around the globe? I'm guessing there's different families of languages and there's some connections between them. So take this as you want. You can either take it as connections within the families of languages or between all of them. Over to you.
Oh, that's a big topic. And it's actually the topic of my next book. Not Dawn on Language, but the one coming next year. The Footprints of Language as a working title. But to answer briefly now, there are lots and lots of connections between languages. Some of them are quite well mapped. A lot of them are well mapped by linguists, sorting the languages of the world into a few hundred families. Some of them surprising if you haven't heard about it before. Like, for example, in India, there are lots and lots of different languages, but some of them have links elsewhere. Hindi and Tamil are two of the major languages in English. Hindi is are two of the major languages in India. And Hindi is more closely related to English than to Tamil. That was a very surprising fact when it was first discovered. But it's been known by linguists for a few hundred years by now. And another surprising fact like that is the languages of the island of Madagascar. The languages there off the coast of Africa are not at all related to other languages in Africa. The linguistic cousins of the people of Madagascar, they live in Borneo, thousands of miles away across the ocean.
Fascinating.
And there are many other oddities like that. But those are the well-known oddities. There have been a lot of discussion, a lot of speculation about connections between different language families. But that's a very contentious issue among linguists. And how much you can bundle together different language families, that's an ongoing debate with much disagreement.
Well, and we'll save that. We can save that one for your next book, which will be fascinating, I'm sure. Please carry on.
Yeah, I just want to pick up one example of a surprising contact that has emerged recently and is still not quite settled. There are many different languages spoken by Native Americans in North and South America. But one connection is between the language family that includes, for example, Navajo in the southwestern United States and a small indigenous language in Siberia, the Ket language. Those languages have remarkable grammatical similarities. And you can make a fairly good case for them being related somewhere deep down in history.
Okay, the final question from us then. So what are the emerging trends in language that those living, say, in 100 years' time from now will see perhaps more clearly than we do currently because of our proximity to the event? So what emerging trends in language that those living in the future will perhaps see more clearly than we do now?
Okay, I would like to raise three different trends. First, a sad one. Languages are dying. Linguistic diversity is disappearing for pretty much the same reason as biological diversity is disappearing. The habitats of small languages are being destroyed, and languages are dying every year. And that trend will continue. And it will be very clear 100 years from now that there are many fewer languages than there are now. And the second trend, that has to do with ways of communicating and how they affect language. And for 99% of our history, and still today for the majority of people, all communication is spoken face-to-face. Our language has evolved face-to-face, and we're shaped by face-to-face communication, adapted to face-to-face communication. But that's changing. Writing was invented a few thousand years ago, but until recently, until 100 years ago, only a small minority actually wrote anything. But then people started writing letters, communicating by letter. People write books, diaries, whatever. And now, after 100 years of frequent writing, written language is quite clearly distinct from spoken language. If you do a detailed study of the grammar and the sentence structures between the written and spoken language as actually used, they are distinct. So language is diverging into a written and a spoken branch. And they are affecting each other in different ways. And in recent years, different ways of communicating have proliferated. We started using telephones quite a while ago. And there we have spoken communication, but not face-to-face, which means that language itself has to carry a lot of the burden that is normally carried by the face and by gestures and so on. And then came broadcast media, like this podcast, where one person is addressing a million. And that's a different way of communicating. That's also new. It used to be one-on-one or a small group where everybody is speaking to each other. Communication one to many, and especially one to many strangers who don't even know who you are. That's something very different from having a face-to-face conversation. And that also affects how you speak. There have been quite a few studies of, for example, political speeches. Language used in political speech is different from conversational speech. And after broadcast media, we got the email. And then we got real-time chat. And then we got video calls, which brought us back a bit closer to face-to-face. And then we got Twitter. And all kinds of different ways of using language. New carriers of language, each one with its own features, its own drawbacks, its own limitation, but also its own possibilities. Like in chat, you couldn't use any your face anymore. You couldn't use tone of voice and so on. And so people substituted smileys and stuff, emojis. And so we got the language that mixes regular language with emojis, with all kinds of other stuff that didn't used to be part of language. So is a smiley a word in the English language now? In one variety of English, in chat English, maybe it is. It has to be included in a linguistic treatment of what people say in chat. And this is a trend I think will be much clearer 100 years from now. Whatever means of communication we come up with in those 100 years, which will be quite a few, I think, they will affect language. Language will diverge into different streams for different usage. And the shape our languages take will be quite different 100 years from now because we are not using them mostly face-to-face anymore. I write more than I speak. I use chat as much as I talk on the phone, and so on. This will affect my language. And the third trend, that has to do with translation. It used to be cumbersome to communicate between languages. It used to be the case that you had to learn the other guy's language in order to communicate effectively, and that took time. But machine translation is just beginning to be usable, just beginning to reach the quality where you can actually have a conversation back and forth, machine translated between speakers of different languages. In practice, between writers of different languages, because machine translation works much better with the written than spoken language. But chatting with somebody using a different language is possible now. And machine translation is rapidly progressing. In the not too distant future, it will probably be possible to have a seamless conversation with somebody speaking a different language. How will that affect us if we won't notice linguistic diversity anymore? It's like in Douglas Adams, you have this perfect little translator fish sitting in your ear. And whenever somebody is speaking an alien tongue, you hear it in your native tongue. If such a system is perfected, we might not even notice that people are speaking different languages. But at the same time, that will be very vulnerable. All our communication will have to pass through a machine translation system, a machine translation infrastructure. Vulnerable to technical problems, vulnerable to privacy violations and spying. How will that affect communication if we are always listened to? That's something we will know 100 years from now. So there we have three trends. Languages are dying. Ways and means of communication are changing. And translation is going mainstream.
Wow, thank you very much. In fact, I used Google Translate today in my preparations for my lessons next week. I was trying to dissect some primary sources in German into English. So it was very, very useful. But you're right. Increasingly, machines are listening to us. My iWatch here often chips in thinking I'm talking to it, as the Siri, my Alexa. So yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I suppose these are only trends that will be amplified and catalyzed and accelerated as time goes on. Thank you very, very much indeed, Sverker. I really appreciate it. Do you just want to give us a rundown of the book and when it's out and its title so people can find it in the shops when it's finally released?
The book is called The Dawn of Language. And it's coming out on the September 2nd, next week. And it is about the dawn of language, how humans first began to use language a million years ago or more.
Fantastic. Thank you very, very much indeed, Dr. Johansson. It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to have you here with us on Versus History. Cannot thank you enough for sharing your research, your wisdom and your expertise. I'm very, very much looking forward to the release of the book. So guys, if you want to get hold of it, you can buy it from the 2nd of September. Just put your hand in your pocket, go and buy it. It's a fantastic book. And keep an eye on our social media feeds, because we've been giving away books at a rate of knots. And you never know, we may well be giving away a copy or two of The Dawn of Language by Sverker Johansson. Away via that medium. So keep your eyes peeled, folks. So Sverker, thank you so much once again for joining us on Versus History. On behalf of myself, the co-editors and all the listeners, we're so, so grateful for you sharing your time, and congratulations on the release of this fantastic new book, The Dawn of Language.
And thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for a very interesting discussion about the book.
Certainly was.
Stimulating questions.
Oh, thank you. Too kind, too kind. Okay, Dr. Johansson, you have a great day and we'll sure speak soon. All the best.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.